Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, car hacking. Have you ever thought there's a slight problem with your car and you find out it gets a virus? Also, victims unite. Many people these days are victims of the courts, particularly now BBC programmes like Rough Justice have been scrapped. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat that number at the end of the show. But we start this week with Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Hi, Sabine, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, let's start with the National Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, because this is a big national news. It started all in July when Norman Tebbit, the former cabinet minister, former chairman of the Conservative Party, said, well, yes, he thinks that there was child abuse covered up back in the 1980s and possibly in the 1990s. And so two inquiries were instituted, one which was run by a civil servant, former civil servant working for Michael Portillo, and there have been questions about whether that's appropriate. And then the other inquiry, the National Inquiry, was set up to report after the general election, conveniently. And that was to be chaired and run by Lady Butler Sloss. But then somebody discovered that Lady Butler Sloss's brother was Attorney General at the time that this abuse was supposed to be going on. So that was deemed to be inappropriate. And she's been replaced by a woman called Fiona Wolfe. Any thoughts on how appropriate Fiona Wolfe is to take over the inquiry?
Well, let's face it, Tony, nobody is appropriate to head that inquiry, except Michael Mansfield has been proposed.
Well, that's right. I noticed that there's lots of childcare professionals have signed up to a petition, an online petition, an online letter, an open letter to Theresa May, the Home Secretary, saying that Mansfield is the man, and without him, it's not going to work. Why is that?
Well, because everybody knows by now that you can read that best up on the Coleman experience, which I love as a WordPress blog. You know, if you just search for filthy Britain, everybody knows how everything is covered up and how criminals commit crimes to cover up crimes again. It is so disgusting that I set up a website called nationalinquiry.wordpress.com end of July, shortly after I got an answer from the Home Office about, you know, just all of these wonderful fancy words. And now I've just been triggered to post something because I've got somebody else in our network got a response from the Home Office saying it is vital that whistleblowers can come forward. Well, the reason why I put up that website, National Inquiry, is because Brian Peed was in prison, and I saw him in the cell below in the court and before and after the hearing. He is.
Can you just tell us who Brian Peed is?
Well, he is not only a survivor of abuse in a national home, he is also a whistleblower of paedophilia in Lambeth Council, of all places. And having been a whistleblower as the head teacher, when he got a teacher dismissed for grooming girls and being racist towards boys, he became the victim of three police forces. He was in prison now. When I saw him, it was for 4 months, and we welcomed him to release him, to get him out. He had been ghosted across 10 prisons in 12 weeks. Nobody has ever heard of such.
So hang on. What do you mean by ghosting?
Well, that's the prison language for moving him from prison to prison to prison so that nobody can get hold of him and get in touch with him, not even his solicitor.
So, what's his connection to this abuse inquiry then?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there cannot be a valid, honest, credible inquiry as long as Brian remains the victim of the system of prison and courts and police, the way that he has been demonstrated.
So what are they saying that he's done then? Because, I mean, there must be two sides to this argument.
Ah, oh, you're such a good journalist. Well, the thing that upsets me more than anything is that he's supposed to have impersonated a barrister, which is, of course, when he does exactly what we are doing, act as a McKinsey friend, as a lay legal advisor.
Okay, so he's decided, for whatever reason, that he cannot have a solicitor acting for him in court. He wants to represent himself, but then he's been accused of impersonating a barrister.
No, this was when he actually helped somebody else. But this is the other twist, ironically. In his own case, he desperately wants legal representation, but for some reason or other, it can't happen. The solicitor whom he wanted was from the firm that represented Baroness Lawrence, the Lawrence case. Well, that solicitor claimed he couldn't visit Brian, and that was exactly for the reason, because he was moved from prison to prison to prison. I managed to see him, at least not in the prison, but at least in the cells in the court, and I was with him seeing this solicitor. But now I get an email saying that the solicitor doesn't seem to have performed, so he will be alone in court on Friday in Cambridge. So I was just writing this email to the Home Office, whether they can please ensure that he gets a fair trial.
So he started out as the whistleblower and then he's now become the victim. But he's the sort of person that probably would be quite valuable to the National Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry.
Well, that's exactly what I initially thought. I should propose that he should become a member of the panel. And I suppose I still need to do that. But of course, he himself is wondering how to take this thing forward. But, you know, there's only so much one can do. But I agree. If the inquiry wants to be taken seriously, wants to be credible, Brian should be on it. I agree entirely.
Okay, so what about Fiona Wolf? It's now being called the Wolf Inquiry. It started in July. I'm not sure if it's even had its first meeting yet. What about her? Is she going to be any good?
I cannot imagine so. I mean, I was just rereading this email that a colleague was sent recently. I mean, it just seems so vague because it is vital that victims feel empowered to come forward to report abuse and that they receive the support needed to help recover from the trauma of this hateful crime. It is therefore imperative that any sort of abuse is reported to the police in order that it can be investigated and those responsible brought to justice. Well, and the previous paragraph says, Fiona Wolf will be chairing the inquiry, which will consider whether public bodies and other non-state institutions have taken seriously their duty of care to protect children from sexual abuse. Well, they obviously haven't.
So that's an answer. But also, I noticed doing a little internet search on Fiona Wolf, it's quite clear that she is in several organisations with Leon Britton. She's got sort of quite a lot of connections to him, and he's one of the people who is being actually accused of involvement with this, or at least covering up for it. So it does seem that I can imagine certainly if I'd been abused and I wanted to go and trust in somebody, confide in them, things that had happened in my past, Fiona Wolf would not be top of my list of people to confide in and trust.
No, absolutely. I mean, it is so obvious that and how she is just, if you like, an establishment figure, but she is not able to do what is required. And I must also tell you that I have read about people who killed themselves when they because of the way that the court dragged them through their memories, if you like. So the support is not there for
them. Well, yes, but I mean, that's surely an argument that this shouldn't really be even dealt with, that the best thing is to just let sleeping dogs lie and not to drag all this stuff up, especially if, you know, people are finding it too painful to cope with and committing suicide.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why I actually feel that compensation for victims should just be on top of the list. But there was one council, I think it was Rotherham, which already said, oh, it's out of time, you know, so they won't get compensation. I mean, it is just unbearable what the system thinks up for itself.
Also, I noticed that there's quite a lot of cuts in the police at the moment. Now, this might be quite good for people like Brian Peed, who's become a victim of the criminal justice system. But overall, I mean, when it comes to child protection, that means there's even less child protection officers out there.
But you know, there still seem to be enough child police officers around to snatch children. I've been sent the links to videos today by an 18-year-old mum. She was in care since she was 13, so she knows the system. She's been running around and away, so she knew even those police officers who then came to take her boy from her. And the little boy is still traumatized, even though she managed to get him back after 6 months by complete miracle, I must say, and tenacity, and even a touching poem, would you believe? She wrote a poem, sent that to everybody involved, and the judge eventually actually realized that it was the social workers who did the dirty work. I mean, you know, it's just lying.
Well, at least, I mean, when you get to the courts, something's done about it. But is anything ever done to social workers that wrongly take children away like that?
A brilliant question, Tony. You see, I know one solicitor whose 4 kids have been taken, and she is taking social workers to court with private prosecutions, but I don't know of anybody else yet, and that seems to be the way forward.
Okay, you talk about child snatching. I mean, this is, you know, it's a pretty scary thought. I can remember as a youngster watching Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. You've got these kind of child catchers out there. So any stray children would be swept up and put in a cage on the back of a horse and cart. Is it really that bad?
Channel 4 publishes one child every 20 minutes. I mean, if that is not bad, what is? They publish that on the on their site, where they talk about the film of 15,000 kids and counting about forced adoption. And you know, only 4% of the children who are taken into care actually do get adopted.
Now, I know for a lot of people, in all sorts of things you're dealing with on victimsunite.net, Sabine, that people don't trust the solicitors, a lot of them. Some of them cannot get solicitors. So what is the main reason why people decide that to defend themselves and to be Mackenzie friends?
Oh, you are such a joy to talk to you, Tony. The disappointment in the system, it goes so far and so deep. For example, this Ian Hamilton, who just passed away at 80, he was to be made bankrupt by the Inland Revenue. Patrick Cullinan was made bankrupt by the Inland Revenue. They end up not getting solicitors, and guaranteed not to work in your interest are those solicitors who are looking after people in prison. That's what I've seen firsthand, and particularly those whose children have been taken. Family courts don't have a chance of getting a solicitor working in your interest. There's one barrister who said about herself, we are professional losers. She hadn't got a child back in 11 years of practicing.
Well, I'm sure surely there are some solicitors. It's just, you know, very, very difficult to find ones that are really trustworthy. So any tips for people looking for a decent solicitor in either of these cases? Say if you know somebody that's in jail and has been put there wrongly, and also for, you know, people who maybe have lost children, had them taken away.
Well, I mean, Ian Josephs, who publishes forcedadoption.com, which I republish as Punishment Without Crime, he put out some recommendations, but we get more and more skeptical about them, I'm afraid. So at this point, I met now a solicitor and a barrister in Park. I was invited to this international conference on child removal proceedings in the Council of Europe countries.
Oh, right. Where was that then?
That was in Prague with a wonderful reception in the old town hall. That was just a week ago, Friday a week ago.
Well, tell us about that. So is that organised by something to do with the EU?
Yeah, the organiser is critically important. The lady who is an agent for the state of Slovakia at the European Court of Human Rights. She was the one who got the 2 boys back who had been in captivity for 920 days, also just briefly before adoption.
Okay, so tell us about the conference.
Well, besides her as the convener, she had managed to get somebody from the European Institute of Law and Forensic Engineering or Science in Prague to become the sponsoring host. So we actually met in the Charles or Karolina University in Prague, and the opening took place in the old town hall because the mayor of Prague was behind it. And a whole bunch of really wonderful dignitaries, if you like. And I mean, the level of support was just superb, and it seems quite critical that small countries are now, if you like, committing themselves. Slovakia first, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic next, and then Latvia. Laila Bryce, who had lost her daughter to, or still has lost her daughter to Merton Council, she, you can see how traumatized she is once we get the recordings of that conference. But she got the support not just from her ambassador, but also from the president of Latvia. And Czech MPs were in Prague as well. And when they heard some of our presentations, they were talking about fascism, of course. Remember, they were used to communism and think that, oh, we're supposed to believe that capitalism is the answer. Well, when you then hear these stories, for example, also from a fabulous lawyer in of the Committee on Human Rights in the Nordic countries, I mean, it's just about as bad as it is in the UK. She talked about a 7-year-old girl, a Gambian girl, who put herself onto the road because hoping that a bus would run over her after she had been taken to care. I mean, this pretense that their children are taken in the best interest is just ridiculous. So to come back to the conference, there's a great conclusion that has been published where the UK is invited to stick to what they agreed to, which is the EU Convention on Human Rights, the UN Convention on Child Rights, and a Parliamentary Assembly resolution of the Council of Europe from 2012, where they all, you know, repeat these nice good words that I read out before, also from the Home Office, but the reality is just so blatantly different.
Well, I noticed at the Conservative Party conference a few weeks ago, they were championing the idea of actually leaving the European Court of Human Rights and having nothing more to do with it.
Well, if that's what they feel they need to do so that they can keep going on to cover take kids and have even less of scrutiny, I like to think that it won't be enough because the human rights cases actually are there's not enough happening, and I don't think the European Court is sort of enough of a leverage. But the small countries and publicity, I think that's what that will break this camel's back.
Yes, it's the, you know, things like the Daily Mail makes such a lot of difference. What about Maurice Kirk? Because we've been following him because he, you know, if people want to go back through our podcasts, you can hear Maurice chit-chatting about his various court cases, most of which, I must say, do seem to be vexatious against him. Basically, he's a sort of a very eccentric chap, but certainly didn't come across as a criminal at all. Much more of a, you know, an interesting vet, an aviator, the Flying Vet he's called. So how's Maurice getting on?
Well, I just got a major package from him where he says he won't be, no court will release him. And he will, so publicity is the only way forward. It is just ridiculous. I cannot imagine how amazed and impressed I am by the fact that his spirit has not been killed yet, but his physical health is in utter danger. He's in a wheelchair. He should have had an operation, as that doesn't happen. So he sent me out a bunch of parcels of documents for each of the various complaints he has to fight. I mean, it starts with prison conditions. He has one telephone number to call. That's his sister. When she travels and is not available, he's completely out of contact. He just occasionally, by chance, more or less, he's allowed to use a computer, and but then he can't print. Then he can't use his money to get stamps. I mean, it's the same thing all over that we've experienced in Holloway. With especially those people whose children have been taken, then they get deported. God only knows what they do with him. I mean, you know, presumably you remember, you knew that he was released and then recalled. Now they want to keep him till March, and they do their damnedest. I'm about to email the governor. I just called to get their email address to at least point them towards the publications that we're doing on the web. Things can't go on. They can't keep going. Especially there's another Mackenzie friend from the area. He, would you believe it, has been blowing the whistle about his GP being, if you like, nearly as bad as the medical non-attention that Maurice has been getting in Peter's case. Well, he is very upset about the fact that he gave some information to the police about the Madeleine McCann case donkeys years ago, and nothing was followed up, nothing was investigated. And his GP deleted a whole bunch of records, or information of his medical records. It's the system of institutions, covers that are used to ultimately to cover the child snatching for the benefit of the pedophiles, includes schools, includes hospitals, includes doctors, and I can give you samples for each of those, and includes the prison and the court system, and the police, and I feel, and social workers, of course, so local councils. And I now, my latest insight is that the CPS seems to be the worst, and they are in on it with the police. In some buildings, they are even in the same place.
No, I can remember going back, covering a story a couple of years ago. In South Wales, one of the chief prosecutors in the Crown Prosecution Service was massively in debt, personally, and he was very easily bribable, and he went to jail for it. So this doesn't sound very good if you've got a Crown Prosecution Service that's being bribed by outside parties, are also they're kind of open to all sorts of temptation. If someone comes in and says, do you need a bit of money? Here's a bit of money. You know, that's surely not how we should be running. That sounds more like some sort of banana republic. But look, going back to Maurice, what about his whole medical situation? Because that seems to be, you know, possibly deadly serious. If he needs an operation, why isn't he getting it?
Well, this is the thing, deadly serious indeed. But ironically, one of the letters that he sent is about arresting a CPS. But and in terms of medical, he is after the former director of the Caswell Clinic, of course, whose report that he made in 2009 about the fact that Maurice supposedly has a brain tumor, which of course is perfectly untrue, that has been used over and over again. And the parole board recently even also admitted to the fact that they used it. And then when I published that on his blog, somebody commented, oh yeah, well, it's well known that parole boards are not trustworthy. You can't win. And with his non-attention to his medical condition, I mean, what can we do from the outside?
Well, all we can do is just highlight it and campaign. But anyway, don't you ever get a bit of too muchness, Sabine? You know, lots going on, isn't there? And you must sometimes feel that you're putting your finger in the dike, but the water is coming across somewhere else, that you're fighting a losing battle.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the video that I, when I had my 6 minutes of passion in Brussels, then somebody picked that up. I kept saying it's too much, and so... Because that's what I kept saying, and it's certainly too much over and over again. It's on the victim side too much. It's on the rescue side too much. We cannot rescue all of the victims that are out there. So as Mackenzie friends, and what's the point in prosecuting even those who are the abusers? Because they always manage to find people to commit crimes to cover up crimes. I really don't know what... I mean, I spoke with somebody today who's also been a serious, serious victim of white-collar crimes. And in the end, all we can do is each on our own, on our best, every single day.
Well, hang on a minute, because your website says Victims Unite, doesn't it? Surely, you know, we're stronger when we've got a shoulder to cry on and someone else to talk to who's been in a similar situation, whether it's geographically living near us or someone who's been in a similar kind of, you know, fraud or child snatching.
Well, that, of course, is exactly the point. And that is true. And it is kind of strange that and how it tends to be the same kind of people over and over again, like this Ian Hamilton I never knew, who just passed away now. I never knew that he had been to some of the meetings that I had organized in Westminster. But it's really very sad when they don't get justice in their lifetime, let alone compensation.
But there are some MPs, aren't there, that have been taking up some of these causes. Obviously, they can't do it all. Would you like to just take us through some of the MPs that you think are actually making a difference?
Well, John Hemming is, of course, the number one for child protection. And then Simon Dunsook and Tom Watson are the people behind the, and Exaro News are the people behind the National Inquiry. And that is now what I want to put before the Home Office again. I especially, would you believe it, Belinda McKenzie and I, as the co-founders of the Association of McKenzie Friends, we have been landed with an order to pay costs in a case where we, of course, worked only pro bono. But just today we established that the Home Office did not put in their next statement of defense. So we may even have to go now for compensation for ourselves. But it's so maybe they are backing off. Maybe. But who knows where things are going to take us.
Okay, well, keep fighting the good fight. Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net. Also, you mentioned there the Coleman experience, didn't you? A National Inquiry blog, victimsunite.net, forcedadoption.com, and Punishment Without Crime. Mm-hmm. Various places that people can go online to get a bit of support and to catch up on this. Sabine McNeil, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for encouraging me, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, we go back now 70 years to 1944, the end game of World War II in Western Europe, and Operation Market Garden. This was the liberation of Holland in September 1944, and featured very famously in the film A Bridge Too Far, which was directed by Richard Attenborough, who died this year. Anyway, I'm joined on the line now by Kees de Hay, who is actually Dutch himself, but he married a Polish woman and he now lives in Poland. Hi, Kees, and welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us what first got you interested in this Operation Market Garden and the liberation of your homeland.
Well, first of all, I live since 2 years in Poland, but I'm born and I'm a retired man now. I'm 65 years old, but I'm born and raised in Holland, and especially in the Arnhem region, in the village of Ede.
You were brought up very near to where this battle happened. Give us an idea of what the memories were, because you were growing up in the 1950s and 60s, as to mm-hmm. what local people felt and what you felt was the legacy of the battle.
Well, first of all, I'm born and raised, and my parents told me to respect our liberators, also the Canadians who came later. But yeah, through the years, I had lots of contacts with British and some Polish veterans. And I'm also interested in all my life in history. And then I got the feeling there is something wrong with Market Garden. It is too many things together that doesn't fit, especially that General Field Marshal Montgomery, who was known as a very careful general, was supposed to be the head of this. So it went on and on, and then I thought, no, there is something terribly wrong there.
During the 1950s, I know I've seen the draft of your book on this, and you say that there were these very expensive German cars going backwards and forwards near your home.
Yes.
Just tell us about that, because Germany had a very, very swift economic recovery, didn't it?
Yes, and that's something that's not. I'm not angry about it, but my whole generation, and that is after the war. We told us it was the German, it was the Marshall help from the Americans. They were afraid Europe would be communist. There would be communist uprisings, and then lots of money was spent in Western Europe, also in Germany. I found out that the Germans in 1944 already made a plan. And which they did, before the end of the war, they saved all their money back on mostly Swiss banks. Even the gold of the tooth of the Jewish people that they murdered, it was melted down in gold bars. It was also brought to Switzerland, and after the war, together with the Marshall Hope, Germany became the number one economic power in Western Europe, and they lost the war. The same thing happened with Japan. They became the most powerful economic power in the Far East. Just the two countries, the two countries who lost the war and did the most and did the most terrible war crimes, they were rewarded. That's my opinion.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? And so take us back to August in 1944, before Operation Market Garden, before the attempted liberation of Holland. What was going on in August 1944, before Operation Market Garden, that influenced the battle, do you think?
It was, I think, and that is my opinion, that is not only in August 44, but all through the war. Let's put it in a nutshell. I think the Russian army, the Russians, were good enough to fight against the Germans, and they did it very good, at the cost of terrible losses. But when they reached the Poland, Romania, in the Balkany, and then they started the fear of how far would the Russians advance to the west. And then where would they stop? There was no agreement whatsoever about it.
Right, so I imagine the Allies, I'm talking about the United States, Great Britain, Canada, people like that were wondering, you know, what's the end game going to look like when the war finishes, when the Germans capitulate? What is the map of Europe going to be? And so they were opened a Western Front in order to make sure that it wasn't just going to be Russia that won the European war on their own.
Yeah, that was the main fear, I think. I'm convinced of that. That is that was really going on.
Okay, so what about the financial arrangements then for the Germans to do with all their looted cash? And what about you know, how did this influence Market Garden?
My opinion is that in August, the end of August, I don't know, this, I don't have the exact date at the moment, but it was end of August, there was a conference in the French city of Strasbourg, in Hotel Rouge. And there the main German industries like Krupp, Mannesmann, IG Farben and so on, who also had before the war huge cooperation with British, especially with American big farms like the American Union Carbide and so on. There was a conference. It was organized by the German Minister of Finance, Hjalmar Schacht, to bring all the German capital and knowledge of their industry in safety to Switzerland. And you must imagine, in Strasbourg, and at that moment, the Third American Army from General Patton had already reached Le Mans near Paris. And that was known with the Allies, that was going on there. And then the British Second Army advanced very quickly to the north. That is to say, one army corps, the 30th Corps of General Horrocks, they conquered, they liberated Brussels, and then they conquered the big port of Antwerp, which was very crucial at that time because the Allied troops did not receive enough goods, fuel, ammunition, and so on. It was impossible to launch a major attack at that time. It was also the General Eisenhower, who gave the order to, that the port of Antwerp, that was our first objective. Without that, a further invasion would be impossible. And then there was this also from the 1st of August, the Allied First Airborne Army was created, a combination of British and American airborne troops, airborne divisions. And they made plans and plans, and one of them was Operation Comet. It was a small version of, a little version of what later was going to be Operation Market Garden. It was the first British airborne division was going to do this. This is so to go through for Eindhoven, Nijmegen to Arnhem. And then that was on the 9th of September 1944. Field Marshal Montgomery cancelled it. It was too dangerous, there was too much resistance, and he said to stop it. The same day, he asked the first Airborne Allies commander, the General Lewis Brereton, to make major airborne attacks on the peninsula of Walcheren. So the port of Antwerp would be available for the Allies. It was very important. And Brereton refused that. I don't know why, but I think he had to follow orders, but he refused. The next day, there was the famous conference on the 10th of September near Brussels, where General Eisenhower met Field Marshal Montgomery. According to the history books, Eisenhower had an injured knee. He couldn't get out of the plane. And my question is, why, if you can go into a plane, why don't you get out of it?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because you do wonder whether maybe that was just simply a security measure, that they wanted to make sure that they could have a conversation that wasn't going to be spied on and possibly get back to the Germans.
That's my argument. It was a very secret conference. And now the history books write, the idea of Market Garden was an idea of Montgomery. I don't believe a word of it. That he was too careful for that. It was not his character. He only attacked when he was practically sure that everything went well. He had experience in the First World War, and he didn't want to get his troops slaughtered. There's nothing wrong with that.
Can you take us into that aircraft? What do you think was going on in that conversation?
I think that Eisenhower had, through secret canals, he had heard that there was a proposition from the Germans, and it is not the first time it happened. All through the war there were secret negotiations and propositions that Hitler would be, in French it is a coup d'etat, in English also, isn't it? To remove Hitler and replace him by someone else. And that was going on the proposition was, and also the Germans always said, we wanted to fight, we want peace with the Western Allies, and we want to fight, to keep on fighting against the Russians. And that is what I call also, what I call the Red Road to Arnhem, the fear of the communism. That was always number one.
Well, why was that then? Because surely the Germans were attacked on both sides, both by the Allies, the Americans and the British on the western side, and the Russians on the eastern side. Why this big fear of communism?
The fear of communism is very simple. It started in after the Russian Revolution in 1917, during World War One. And then huge capitals were nationalized, confiscated by the communist regime of Lenin, and And that is also the cause what happened after the First World War, the rise of the fascist regimes. They were a reaction on the what happened in Germany. There was also a threat of a communist revolution. Adolf Hitler was financially, he received millions from the German industry, also from America, especially from Henry Ford, about what I know about it, about 30, in those days, $30 million, that's a lot of money, nowadays and then even, multiply it with 10 years, we speak about $300 million nowadays. And everything because of the fear of communism. That is always what I call my red road.
Taking us back to the Red House meeting in Strasbourg in August, what did the Nazis end up doing with a lot of the loot? Because they'd been all around the capitals of Europe, taking gold and securities, paintings, artworks, everything, and hoarding it in Berlin. And there's been a lot of questions after the war as to where did that all go to?
The artworks, well, what I know about it, Hermann Göring was in a, he loved that. But indeed, even nowadays, lots of artworks, and especially what is stolen from the Jewish people, it is still not found yet. That's what I know about it.
And what about the gold?
The gold, what I told you, it was melted down in gold bars and then sent to Switzerland. And they had no problems with that, the Swiss government. Because, for example, in 1945, just before the end of the war, the Germans were still occupying northern Italy, and they decided even not to kill the Jewish people and send them to the concentration camps to murder them. The Swiss government allowed them to, because that was the only left route, the safe route to do that, through the neutral Switzerland to Germany and Poland, where they were murdered. But that was no problem for the Swiss government.
Well, a lot of the money was controlled by Hitler's secretary. Some would call him the treasurer, Martin Bormann. What are your thoughts about him? Because some people say he committed suicide, some people that he was killed, and others that he survived the war.
I think, but that is what some people say. Officially, his remains were found here during the communist regime in the former DDR, the East Germany, in Berlin. And then his former dentist identified him by heart, because he had no papers anymore, by heart, that these are the tooth of Martin Bormann, though I don't believe a word of it. There was a German general, his name is Reinhard Gehlen. He was the chief of the German Abwehr, the German Secret Service. And he wrote a book about it. After the war, he came in, he became the new German chief of the German intelligence after the war of Western Germany. And he said that Martin Bormann was a Russian agent. Through the war, he gave the Russians all the information about German plans and tactics. These are the words of Reinhard Gehlen. And I believe him.
Okay, well, back to Holland, back to Arnhem. What do you think the lessons are that we should look back on Arnhem? Because the official story is that it was all a big mistake, and you don't believe that.
I don't believe it. I believe that, and now I come back to the conference on the 10th of September in Brussels, that General Eisenhower had information, because when you look at the tactics, the first, what Eisenhower, the first, his first responsibility was to have a proper big port to supply his troops. And at that moment, there was nothing, none whatsoever. Operation, the landing on Normandy, Operation Overlord, was weeks before ahead of the schedule. He had lots of troops, everything he had, Eisenhower, but he had no fuel and ammunition to support his troops. What he needed was a big port, and that was Antwerp, and that was conquered. And from one day on the other, he changed his mind, and then what I think, he had information there would be a switch of power in Germany, and then the northern part of my country, Holland and Netherlands, would be demilitarized, to say it right, and then there would be a German-friendly government for a short period. Arnhem would be the guarantee, the assurance the Brits had there for the Allies, and then the Allied troops would wait again behind the Rhine, and the Germans would keep on fighting and try to drive the Russians back.
Okay.
And that all because of the fear of communism. That is my opinion.
Okay. Just tell us about your forthcoming book, because I know you've got a draft of a book out, and when you hope to publish it.
At the moment, I'm still working, get additional information, and I'm going to... At the moment, it is in the Dutch language. You have an English copy of me. It's a very poor translation. But I will publish it as an e-book, as an electronic book. And when it's going to happen in a few weeks, I think.
What's the title?
The English word is The Red Road to Arnhem. And in Holland, we have, in the Dutch language, we have a saying that's called The Red Road. The Rode Draad. I don't know how to translate it. It is something what happens in your life. Every time it comes back. And then and what I mean is the fear of communism since the Russian Revolution.
Oh, okay.
And of course, I am describing.
Well, there's maybe the same thing going on today, Keish.
Yeah, I think so. I really understood. What do you think? What is going on in the world now?
It certainly seems to be, not much friendliness between the old communist China and Russia. Although, of course, they're not really communist anymore. But anyway, Keish de Haye, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
And I want to thank you for giving me the chance to give my opinion. Goodbye, Tony.
Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And Jeff Sparks is back after a few weeks off. How are you doing, Jeff?
Not too bad, thanks.
With his What's On Guide.
Thank you. This is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 17th of October, Alien Stash Tin will be performing with support from Maori and also Featherhead at the Hatchet in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Entry is £2 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. Also on 17th of October, Disraeli and the Small Gods will be performing with support from Kate Ferris at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Into Song of the Week, and I present Slash. During his career, he has performed with Guns N' Roses, founded Slash's Snake Pit and co-founded Velvet Revolver. He released his first solo album in 2010 titled Slash, which featured a roster of guest musicians, and both his second solo album titled Apocalyptic Love and third solo album titled World on Fire featured Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators. This is from the album World on Fire, which was released this year, and it's titled Withered Delilah.
You had a break out.
Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators with the track Withered Delilah from the album World on Fire. Into Saturday 18th of October, Feed the Rhino will be performing with support from Night Versus, Baby Godzilla and Koshiro at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance, doors open at 7pm. Finally on Sunday 19th of October, Spear of Destiny will be performing with support from Idiot Strength and The Blush at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £13.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm.
Hang on, Jeff, just before you say goodbye, just remind us of when Disraeli and the Small Gods are on, because they really are one of the great little up-and-coming bands in the city, aren't they?
Yeah, they're on Friday 17th of October with support from Kate Ferris at the Fleece. And tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7pm. So that is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Lovely to have you back, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11am every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sabine McNeil from Victims Unite and Keish DeHay, from the author of Red Road to Arnhem, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Just call him the Five Piper. So I know you wanna see Jimmy Z on the FLUTE, yeah.
All I want to do is play my fucking flute for you. All I want to do is play my fucking flute.
you like it, so yo, would you just come closer so you can see who's playing that funky sound that's going down, nigga, saying that Jimmy Z is the one you like to see on the FLU-TV, yeah.
All I want to do is play my funky blues for you.
Listen to the sounds of the funky blues.
Drum and bass style on Kiss.